The next case is James E., number 032973, James E. Pinkson against Anthony Mandry. Ms. Thompson.
May it please the court. In the order of this court designating counsel for this appeal, a panel of this court indicated that it had concerns about the division of labor employed by the lower court, where the magistrate judge, without the consent of Mr. Pinkston, conducted what looked like a bench trial under the guise of an evidentiary hearing. The appellant has addressed this issue in its briefs, and we'll discuss this issue further today. The concern with the underlying proceeding in the district court judge's review of the magistrate judge's report and recommendation was that it was incomplete. It's because of the district court judge's rubber stamping of that report and recommendation that this court should remand this case back to the district court for further proceedings.
And do what?
And at the very least,
what should the district court do?
The district court should re-review Mr. Pinkston's objections and, in its order, either affirming or rejecting the magistrate judge's report and recommendation, indicate what its decision was with respect to Mr. Pinkston's objections. Under the Federal Magistrate Act, when an inmate brings a suit challenging a condition of confinement, as Mr. Pinkston did here, a district court judge can refer that case to a magistrate judge to conduct whatever proceedings are necessary, including an evidentiary hearing.
What claim didn't the magistrate fully address?
Mr. Pinkston made several objections to the magistrate judge's opinion.
What claim did he not fully address, in your opinion? Which one? Or which one?
Mr. Pinkston's Eighth Amendment claim, both the failure to protect and the failure to provide medical care. Both of those, Mr. Pinkston made objections with respect to both of those claims, the way that the magistrate judge resolved both of those claims.
Your belief is that the magistrate didn't address them thoroughly enough, to your satisfaction?
That the magistrate judge did not?
Right.
Well, Mr. Pinkston made objections to that opinion. The problem
here... I didn't say he didn't make objections. I said, what else could the magistrate judge have done to satisfy your objections?
Well, our concern here is with what the district court said, but with respect to the magistrate judge, Mr. Pinkston made specific objections about some of the magistrate judge's findings, specifically that he had contradicted himself in the allegations he made in his complaint versus what he said at trial, and also how the magistrate judge characterized what one of the witnesses, Mr. Merriweather, an inmate witness, what he had said about Mr. Pinkston's claims. Both of those, for one, are issues that were not fully addressed in the magistrate judge's opinion. In addition, Mr. Pinkston made both legal and factual arguments about why he had, in fact, met his burden of proof and had legally shown that there was an Eighth Amendment violation. Now, it's true that the magistrate judge covered these general issues in his report and recommendation, but the specific issues that Mr. Pinkston addressed in his objections were not covered by the magistrate judge's opinion. And we submit that it was the district court's responsibility when it reviewed those objections to indicate its reasons for reaching its opinion, its reasons for adopting in full the magistrate judge's report and recommendation in spite of those objections. Now, we admit that in every case there may be some objections that are made that will in fact be covered by the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. And so in those cases, under both the Federal Magistrate Act and under Circuit Rule 50, which I'd like to discuss in a minute, it's probably appropriate for the district court judge to simply say, in spite of those objections, I adopt fully the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. But in cases such as this, where there are issues that are sort of left hanging, even after the magistrate judge has issued a report and recommendation, the district court judge should discuss those objections or at least explain why he didn't find those objections to be convincing when he issues his final order or his final decision, either adopting or rejecting that opinion. Now, in addition to this outcome being appropriate under the Federal Magistrate Act, as I said, it's also appropriate under this court's, under Circuit Rule 50 of this court. Circuit Rule 50 as cases have said and as the rule itself says, means that a district court or any judge in reaching an opinion needs to explain the reasons for its decision, in part so an appellate court can understand why that decision was reached. And here, although we can speculate about why the district court rejected Mr. Pinkston's objections, we don't really know. And under Circuit Rule 50 and the cases discussing it, we're not required to guess. It's incumbent upon the district court judge to fully explain that so that we understand the reasons for that opinion. Also, I want to emphasize that really simply requiring a district court judge in certain cases to more fully explain his reasoning does not really require that much more of the district court judge. As here in his opinion, the district court judge said that he had already reviewed the report and recommendation, that he had reviewed the plaintiff's objections, and that he had conducted a de novo review of the transcript. So we're actually not asking the district court judge to really do that much more. We're simply asking him to make a record of his thought process so that we have that.
He said that he reviewed the record thoroughly, didn't he?
He did.
And he inscribed his approval as to the magistrate judge's finding?
He did.
What else can he do to satisfy you?
Well, again, as we've said, in this case, the district court judge needs to explain specifically why Mr. Pinkston's objections did not change his opinion, because those objections are issues that are not addressed in the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. So nowhere between the two, between either the judge's order or the report and recommendation, has Mr. Pinkston had those objections addressed by the court. And as I said, to follow up on the point about this not being too much more of a burden, simply documenting those, his consideration of those objections, is really not a huge burden, because it still allows the magistrate judge to conduct most of the legwork. We understand that the Federal Magistrate Act, the purpose of it is to remove a lot of the burden of these cases, and admittedly there are many in the courts, to allow the magistrate judge to take some of that burden. But all of the cases discussing the Federal Magistrate Act make clear that even though they allow the magistrate judges in general to take a lot of that burden.
Did you agree that he heard the case?
No, in this case, and that's an important point, in this case Mr. Pinkston did not give his consent for a magistrate judge to conduct a hearing. You know, under the Federal Magistrate Act, when a party...
Did he disagree?
Did he affirmatively... I don't think there's anything in the record, at least, that shows a particular objection by Mr. Pinkston, but he never affirmatively consented to this. The order was given without his consent.
Okay. No, I said, did he agree to the magistrate judge hearing the matter initially?
No, he did not.
And did he disagree?
Again, I don't think there's anything on the record that indicates that he disagreed, although there is some indication in the record that initially Mr. Pinkston wanted a jury trial, although he did not renew that request. And so it seems clear that Mr. Pinkston, and particularly the fact that he had objections to the magistrate judge's opinion, indicated that he very much wanted the district court to be involved in the ultimate decision making. Otherwise, he wouldn't have objected to the magistrate judge's
after the
finding.
Fact.
Well, at least after the fact. If this court has no more questions at this time, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. We'll hear now from Mr. Sherman.
May it please the court. The district court conducted a proper de novo review of the magistrate judge's report. Under Title 28, Section 636B1B of the U.S. Code and Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 72B, the district judge should make a de novo determination of those portions of the magistrate's report and recommendations to which objections have been filed. A de novo determination requires that the district court review the magistrate's findings and determine whether reliance should be placed on those findings. After such de novo review, this court has previously held that the district judge may accept the recommended decision, and that is exactly what happened in this case. There is nothing in the record before this court that would suggest that the district court did not conduct a de novo review as it claimed. Where the district court says that de novo review has occurred, that should suffice. For example, in U.S. versus Raddatz, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that in providing for a de novo determination rather than a de novo hearing, Congress intended to permit whatever reliance a district judge chose to place in a magistrate's proposed findings and recommendations. Other federal circuit courts that have previously addressed this issue have held that a brief order expressly stating that the district court conducted de novo review is sufficient. For example, in Coding versus Thompson, the district court stated that it conducted the independent required review and it considered Cody's objections. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals noted that the district court was not required to reiterate the findings and conclusions of the magistrate judge and found that this was sufficient. Also, in the matter of Grego, the district court's order stated that the court had made a de novo determination of those portions of the magistrate's proposed findings and recommendations objected to. Grego claimed this showed that the district court had not adequately reviewed the magistrate's recommendations. The Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals disagreed and noted that the district court was simply repeating the language of 636B1 to indicate its compliance. The court noted that this was common practice among district judges to make such a statement and adopt the magistrate's report when they find that the magistrate judge has dealt with the issue fully and that they could add little of value to that analysis. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals has also held that a district court statement that it performed a de novo review is sufficient and even common among district courts. Likewise, Circuit Rule 50 only requires that when a district court resolves any claim on the merits, that it give its reasons either orally or on the record or by written statement. Nothing in the language of the rule indicates that a district court may not rely upon the magistrate's reasons when the court is in complete agreement with the magistrate's report. Affirming by adoption does not imply that the district court has neglected its duties. Rather, it means that after an independent review, the district court has come to the same conclusions as the magistrate, and for the reasons that judge gave, rendering further explanation is not necessary. Further, it should also be pointed out that this court has consistently held that lack of an explanation by a district court does not necessarily require remand where the reasons are apparent from the record, as is the case here. With regard to the merits of Pinkston's claim, this court has previously held that it reviews the district court's findings of fact under a clearly erroneous standard and also reviews the district court's application of a legal standard by the same clear error standard. A prison official cannot be found liable under the Eighth Amendment for denying an inmate humane conditions of confinement unless the official knows of and disregards an excessive risk to inmate health or safety. Regarding Pinkston's claim and Officer Grizel, he himself acknowledged that she did not have any knowledge the alleged fight was taking place. She cannot be found liable for preventing something of which she was unaware. With regard to Officer Majorie, Majorie denied ever opening both Pinkston and another inmate's cell doors at the same time so that a fight could take place. His testimony was corroborated by evidence showing that it was physically impossible for a single officer to open an inmate's cell door from the control tower, as Pinkston alleged. The district court properly determined that Pinkston's testimony was insufficient to prove his version of events. In his complaint, Pinkston claimed that Majorie opened the cell door from the control booth, and at the hearing, he testified that Majorie opened the cell door from the control booth while Grizel was talking on the phone. However, later he testified there could have been an unknown person outside his door who pushed the button on the door, which opened the cell. But at the conclusion of his argument, he again stated that it was Majorie who opened the cell door from the control booth and not some unknown person outside his door.
Is the reason this requires two people is one's remote and one's on next to the door? You have to have a key and some remote control?
First, a person in the control tower must give power to the cell door, and then another individual at the cell door must actually push a button which opens the door. So it requires two persons to open a cell.
So one person can't do it.
Right. A person in the control tower is incapable of opening the cell door by themselves. The district court also correctly concluded that even had Pinkston established that officers Majorie and Grizel were aware of his injuries, they were not of the severity necessary to sustain a claim under the Eighth Amendment. Clinician Babcock testified that when she examined Pinkston, she noted only a puffy lip and a swollen eye. Pinkston was required to prove that he had an objectively serious medical need, which is one that has either been diagnosed by a physician as mandating treatment, or one that is so obvious that even a layperson would easily recognize the necessity for a doctor's attention. Pinkston's injuries did not rise to the level at which a layperson would easily recognize a doctor's attention is required. Moreover, according to Pinkston, Grizel did attend to his injuries. Pinkston testified at the hearing that Grizel obtained skin closures, band-aids, and ice for Pinkston. By way of comparison, in Wells versus Franson, which is a 1985 case decided by the circuit, Wells complained that he was shackled to his bed for 9 days by Illinois prison officials, which resulted in bruises, abrasions, headaches, restriction of blood flow, and rashes. This court held that the plaintiff had no basis to claim that prison officials displayed deliberate indifference to his alleged serious medical needs, because he was treated with calamine lotion and given Darvon for his headaches. And while that treatment was apparently not as prompt as one in the plaintiff's position might have wished, the fact that he was treated generally defeats a claim of deliberate indifference. Also, in Langston versus Peters, a 1996 case decided by this court, an inmate claimed that he informed a correctional officer that he had been raped, and the officer simply responded that he would have to work it out for himself. Eventually, the inmate was able to pass a note to a medical technician. This court noted that while the officer's response was inappropriate, if indeed the inmate had been raped, as he alleged, that alone did not make it a constitutional violation. The court stated that the officer's failure to obtain immediate medical treatment for the inmate constituted an Eighth Amendment violation only if the delay was objectively sufficiently serious. The court noted in the past it has held that a 2-hour delay is not unreasonably long to wait for an examination, and pointed out that the public often waits longer at hospital emergency rooms. Further, this court noted that an inmate must place verifying medical evidence in the record establishing the detrimental effect of a delay in medical treatment to succeed. Here, Pinkston did not place any evidence in the record establishing what effect any delay in him not receiving treatment had on his injuries. He simply alleged that sometime between 7 and 11, these injuries occurred, and that he was provided medical treatment by Grizel. But he did not submit a medical request form until 4 days after the alleged incident, and then he subsequently refused medical treatment. Thus, even had Pinkston been able to establish any detrimental effect, it was only because of his delay in submitting a medical request form.
Mr. Sherman, before your time expires, I would appreciate your addressing the problem of the advice the magistrate judge gave the prisoner with respect to the calling of witnesses. Wouldn't a reasonable prisoner, having received that letter from the magistrate judge, have thought he simply had the right to call? He was going to get one prisoner to testify as to what happened at the time of the altercation, and that was it?
I would note initially that Pinkston did not file an objection on this basis before the district court, which this court has consistently held would forfeit such a claim before this court. But regarding his claim, the magistrate did not deny him the ability to call more than one prisoner witness. May I can finish?
Yes, please.
Okay. It simply informed him of its desire to avoid needless cumulative testimony, which is its prerogative under Federal Rule of Evidence 403. Nothing in the magistrate's letter to Pinkston prevented him calling one or more witnesses who had actually seen the alleged fight. It simply informed him that it would not require several witnesses to testify to the same thing. Thank you. The state would respectfully ask this court to affirm the district court in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. Ms. Thompson, you have 2 minutes. Ms. Thompson, with respect to this last matter I raised, do you agree that this matter was forfeited at the district court level?
I agree that Mr. Pinkston did not raise an objection to the district court, but I think given the timing of the letter that it was difficult for him to even know that he had an issue to raise here. He received this letter before he had his evidentiary hearing, and I think Mr. Pinkston assumed that because he'd already received this letter saying that the magistrate judge would not allow more than one witness to be called, he didn't even know that this was an issue that he could object to. I think because this came in a letter in which the magistrate judge was purporting to explain to Mr. Pinkston the procedure of the case, that he believed this is just how the evidentiary hearing would be carried out. I don't think that he believed that he had an issue that he could object to here. But I would point out that the problem with this letter of the magistrate judge telling Mr. Pinkston to not expect him to allow him to call more than one witness to testify to the same thing underlies some of the problems that Mr. Pinkston faced in this case and illustrates again why it was important for the district court to consider his objections. The magistrate judge conducted this evidentiary hearing and in some respects put Mr. Pinkston in a catch-22 because this letter really only allowed Mr. Pinkston to call a limited number of witnesses to corroborate his story. And so his objections, in essence, became an important time for Mr. Pinkston to reaffirm to this court and to argue again that he had, in fact, met his burden and that he had, in fact, shown factually that an Eighth Amendment violation had occurred. And so for this reason, it's even more important for the district court judge to exercise its ultimate decision-making authority and to consider those objections when reaching its opinion.
But he didn't make such an objection, am I right?
He did not. That's correct. Finally, I just want to emphasize one more point, which is that asking the district court judge to make a record of how he considered these objections is not merely a matter of ensuring that the district court, in fact, did consider the objections or did make a de novo review. We're not merely claiming that the district court judge has to put this down so that we know he, in fact, did it. May I just finish this point?
Sure.
But so that we understand what the reasoning was. An Article III judge, when exercising its ultimate decision-making authority, has to let us know, one, that he exercised the authority, but two, how he exercised that authority. And so for this reason, we ask that this court remand this case back to the district court judge for further action. Thank you.
Ms. Thompson, you took this case by the request of the court, as I understand it.
I did.
You have the deep thanks of the court for the great efforts that you expended on behalf of your client, and your law firm certainly has the deep thanks of the court for having expended their resources to assist us in this regard. Indeed, our thanks to all counsel for their fine presentations today. The case will be taken under advisement.